Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Chris Keating from the Hartford Current. By the way, a little factoid for you. I love Today in Connecticut History. Today in 1901, this is great, Connecticut became the first state in America to pass a law to limit the speed of automobiles. 12 miles an hour in the city, 50 miles an hour in the rural roads. And if you saw a horse and it bothered the horse, you had to stop your vehicle completely. I mean, Chris, you must remember when they put that into effect, right?
Horse and buggies? Yeah. Now, I defer to Steve Kochko, who was covering since Governor Trumbull. Jonathan Trumbull.
Listen, first of all, thanks for coming in. I know it's a busy time of year with the session. You know, we were just talking about backgrounds and so on and so forth. And, you know, how long have you been doing this in Connecticut?
40 years, believe it or not.
All with the Current? Or?
No. I worked for the Greenwich paper, believe it or not, a million years ago in the 1980s. That's how I met Ned Lamont. Met Ned Lamont like around 1985.
Because he ran against Lieberman, you know, 20-something years ago, but 85 is even 17 years before that.
I covered Lamont when he was on the running for the Board of Selectmen in Greenwich.
Did he win?
Yes, well, he won. He became like the third selectman. There's a three-member board, and he got the third seat. There was, in those days, only three people in the world knew who he was, Lamont, his wife, and me. that was it. I mean, no, nobody knew who he was.
Now, to be honest, I mean, you know, listen, we know his wealth, and we know he tried for a long time to get into office, and he finally did. Would you have been shocked in 85 if we told you he would be a two-term, possibly three-term governor?
Yeah. Maybe I'm not good at projecting.
He's a little socially awkward. I don't know if that was the same back then.
Yeah, I mean, I just wouldn't have projected it. excuse me. At that time, John Olson was the chair of the Democratic Town Committee in Greenwich, and he became the state AFL-CIO president for, like, I don't know, 20, 25 years, et cetera. So there would be people down there in Greenwich that you couldn't project. How it all started was Lamont was friends with Weicker back then. So I'm talking in the 80s when Weicker was a U.S. senator, and then he ran for governor, as you know, in 1990. So he was friends with Lamont way, way, way long ago. But Lamont was, he didn't stand out at that time. He was probably 33 years old, maybe something like that. I think he's about 71 now. So I don't want to say he was just another guy in Greenwich, but he was not viewed as like a super wealthy guy or anything like that. No.
Interesting. Or a rising star in politics. I mean,
he was a sharp guy. He was a sharp guy. They wanted him to run for first selectman, and he didn't do it because it was a full-time job and he had his business. They were pressuring him, the Democrats. You got to run for first selectman. He didn't do it. So they weren't very happy with that.
We're talking about Chris Keating here. You know, we can only talk about the budget so much. We're going to talk to you throughout the hour. I do want to, you know, in our next little segment, go back a little bit because, you know, people who read the paper have known you for years, but then there's also a slice audience who doesn't know you as well. And like, I talk to young people all the time about who want to be in broadcasting or in journalism. And like, part of me is like, really? Do you? But then at the same time, I wonder, you know, there still has to... We have to have them, and we're going to take a break here, but when we come back, I want to make sure we have a full chunk of time. I want to talk about the process of being edited, and you know, because there's no more newsroom, and there was a really fascinating conversation I listened to in Boston on sports radio about how the sports journalists don't hold management, coaches, players accountable enough, and one theory put forth was the lack of editing. Like if you had an editor who pushed you, who made you go do things that maybe you wouldn't have or didn't want to. And that layer, and think about it, and we'll get your response, that layer weakening has affected journalism in ways that maybe haven't been discussed. Hold your response. We'll talk about that on the other side. We're back here with Chris Keating from the Hartford Current. You go to current.com. Just go Keating and Current on your Google, and you can get to his jump page and read everything. And we'll get to the budget and pay raises for state police and all this other stuff. But I wanted to, I'm always a journal. I love journalism. And you're a real, like, legit journalist. You not only, you said your first published article was?
Sixth grade in my homeroom newspaper. Sixth grade.
What was the piece on? Do you still have a hard copy?
No, it was a sports article. I actually started as a sports writer. It was a sports article. We just did, for whatever reason, a, quote, homeroom newspaper. And my handwriting was very terrible. And another kid wrote it, actually, for me, who had way much better penmanship. My memory was it was about the L.A. Lakers and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, believe it or not.
What? Did you know then, like early on, you wanted to do this, or is this a late?
Kind of. I remember watching the Super Bowl, like when I was 8 or 9 years old, and instead of just watching the game, I started writing everything down, what was happening. No one asked me to do that. I thought it was important to write down what was happening, including the statistics of the game. No one else in my family was doing anything like that. They were watching the game, saying, "Hey, this is great. It's a good, interesting game here." But I've always had reason to do that. The amount of notes I take on things is unbelievable, actually, and it helps me remember things.
And so you grew up on Long Island.
Yep.
Went to Fordham. Did you start your career there? Because, was that when you started to write in earnest, or not even there?
Fordham, well, in high school, I was on the student newspaper. We had all 4 years. I went to Chaminade High School in Long Island, which is a very good school. So the freshmen had a paper, the sophomores had a paper, the juniors had a paper. So I was—
Like a weekly or a monthly? Or
like a weekly.
Yeah.
So I basically, in ninth grade, I basically started writing weekly, and I've never stopped, straight through.
Did you go straight from Fordham to Columbia J School?
No. Through Fordham, I got a job at Newsweek Magazine in the heyday of Newsweek Magazine. It was incredible. We can talk about that if you want. I was in the photo department, which was also an amazing place with amazing people. Might have been dysfunctional, but a lot of fun. And then I went to Columbia like a year and a half later, 2 years later.
The thing about that, you know, I interned at a magazine for Winter Media, that they did Rolling Stone, Us Magazine, and Men's Journal. And magazines have a different pace than a newspaper. But Newsweek, for, you know, many of our audience would remember. I mean, it was Time and Newsweek were the news magazines in America. And for people younger who don't remember, pre-internet, you could put out a weekly news publication that wasn't all features and still would be relevant, right? There were newsy items that people wouldn't have necessarily gotten in other places, but I can't imagine the intensity of the deadlines there. Putting that thing together must have been insane.
It was unbelievable. I would work a Friday night into Saturday morning, 3, 4, 5 in the morning. What would happen at Newsweek, you would try to get it as timely as possible, right? So it might be delivered to your house on Monday morning. So Friday night was insane. And sometimes I'd stay overnight in hotels, fancy hotels in Manhattan that I never paid for, and then work on Saturday too. But the deadlines, you know, if you came to Newsweek in the heyday at like midnight on a Friday night, there'd be a gazillion people there working, going crazy.
That must have been amazing. Was there a self-awareness of how kind of amazing that experience was?
Yeah, I think.
Or it's only in the backdrop of what it looks like today?
I think I knew at the time, maybe I didn't think it was going to end. In other words, by that I mean the money. Newsweek eventually stopped publishing, as you know. But I was there in the heyday. Like I said, I was probably the lowest, newest guy there. Like I said, I was in the photo department. But the type of money, I'll tell you a fast story. When Anwar Sadat was killed over in Egypt, as you know, that was a huge deal.
They made a peace deal with Israel, and then he was assassinated, correct?
Yes. Anwar Sadat, some of your listeners will remember him. Anyway, they chartered a plane. Newsweek chartered a plane just to pick up the film from the guy who was shooting it there at the time and ran incredible pictures. So this is pre pre-digital, pre-everything. My job sometimes was to rent a car, drive out to Teterboro Airport, and pick up film that had been flown in a private jet. There was only three people on the jet, the pilot, one of our Newsweek people, and, a tray of shrimp on the front of the thing.
Again, Teterboro is a private jet. Airport, basically private jets in New Jersey, right?
Yes, in Jersey, right.
And we're talking with Chris Keating from the Hartford Courant. This is the stuff I've looked forward to talking about with you forever. And, I want to bring back the conversation that I teased before our last break, which is the process. Now these organizations, what would you say that editorial staff is? 20% of what it was 20 years ago? 30%? What is it?
At our place?
Yeah.
Probably 10%.
So 90% gone.
Correct.
Do you produce a publication and a website on 10% of what you had 25 years ago? What about that concept? I know that you've been doing it for so long that you know what to do and you're trusted to do the job the right way. But what about the medium reporters and columnists or the young ones? Is there a rigorous enough editorial process, and how can you when you have such small staff?
Well, in the old days,
and this is not just the current. It's not about the current. This is about journalism in general.
No, it's all of them, unfortunately. So when you in our business, we call it typos, which typos can get into newspapers and any newspaper. We had a quote copy desk. I remember just kind of for what we called the state system. We had 55 copy editors in like 1994, 95. Obviously, we don't have anything like that. We don't have any. We have got zero.
Spell check.
Basically, spell check, and you kind of got to do it on your own. There's less and less eyeballs looking at things. Don't get me wrong. Editors do look at things. Yes, they do. But in the old days, even New York Times has less copy editors, unfortunately. But no, we had a massive staff. When I started at The Current, I was in the Enfield Bureau. We had 12 or 14 reporters just in the Enfield Bureau. My job was to write only about Enfield. That's what I did, only Enfield. And you had to have a story on Enfield every single day.
So I could talk about this all day long. Do you think the holding people to account element of journalism is hurt by not having more editorial oversight at publications?
Well, less people in general. We had a guy at the Current named John Lender, one of the greatest reporters I've ever known. Just the loss of him is a huge blow to the state of Connecticut, as far as I'm concerned. Politicians love it because they're held to less account.
Yeah, do what they want.
Yes.
I this is where I get to, because this news desert concept. The you had 12 reporters in Enfield. Now there are none.
None, right?
And again, this is indicative of newspapers across the country and the world.
Totally.
So this is not it's not criticism, but whatever commentary is not about The Current. I love The Current.
A lot worse at other places.
But what about this concept of news deserts and the fact that some municipalities can operate almost unchecked? And will there be some way to circle back, and will there be some sort of revitalization of, hyper-local news, and how would that happen? Or do you think it's just sort of gone for good?
It's hard. It's very, very hard. People ask you, what is it going to mean? The answer is George Santos on Long Island. George Santos ran for Congress on a complete lie. He lied about what college he went to, said he worked at Goldman Sachs, and he didn't. The guy got elected to Congress. So my point being that if there's no newspapers covering it and nobody knows anything about it, the people who can get elected is unbelievable, much less, you're living in town XYZ and you see a building going up and you say, how'd that go in there? Well, the newspaper never covered the Planning and Zoning Commission. It was approved. And suddenly this monster building is going up and you didn't know about it. And you live in town. You live in Farmington or wherever the heck you live.
Will that ever
kind of things.
Right. But will that ever
swing back?
And how would it? Because Patch doesn't work that way well enough. And newspapers, like the even the Boston Globe aren't going to be able to get back into communities. The Swampscott Reporter, I don't even know if it exists. To me, that's a problem. It's in terms of people can really run away with things without getting checked.
Yeah, in the short term, I don't see it. I don't foresee it. I don't want to, and I'm not, you know, I'm an optimistic guy. But in the short term, I don't see it. You need people who care. You need people with brains. It's a lot of work. Even if you're running a website, it's a lot of work to keep an eyeball on. Again, you're following towns, you know, what's going on at the school board? What's going on at the zoning commission in town XYZ, much less 10, 15, 20 towns? It's not easy. It is not easy.
His name is Chris Keating. Again, go to current.com. The front page article today is the State House okay state police raises, which we'll get to. We'll get to the budget and a whole bunch of other issues. All right, welcome back. We're here with Chris Keating of the Hartford Current, talking about a lot of stuff. We should hit a bar stool at some point and continue that conversation. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. You got to experience the power of Tommy outside. Yeah.
Fantastic guy with the cart here. Phenomenal coffee here in beautiful Executive Drive.
So you know what? By the way, you have a classic journalism breakfast of champions. He's got a corn muffin, Famous Amos cookies, and a cup of black coffee. Or a cup of coffee. I mean, that is the journalist special right there.
Breakfast of champions.
Yes. Let's talk. I'm going to give you sort of an open-ended question about things at the Capitol. We've talked a ton about the budget. There's a lot of bills. Other bills right now. You did the state police raises yesterday that it was some Republicans voted for it, so it was bipartisan, right? But I want to what's going on right now that you think people, to start us off here, that people need to know about?
Well, big things. I mean, the state budget, there's supposed to be a vote on that like late next week. The state budget, sometimes people think they're a little removed from that, but it's a gigantic animal. It's going to be $27 billion. And what does all that mean? Every group under the sun, from the nonprofits to whatever, have been at the Capitol every single day banging the drums. If you notice, the unions, nobody ever wants to strike until like right now, which is when the budget is being done. You never hear about a strike in August.
Is it really time like that? I didn't really think about
it. Oh, big time. There's never been. I've been there more than 30 years back to Lowell Weicker. We could talk about that. But I mean, there's never a strike around Christmas time or something like that. The strikes are set up because normally they get the money that they need right around this time, which is budget time.
So why is it beneficial for unions to choose now to do that?
Because you can pressure legislators and you can get more money. You'd have to bring the unions in and let them talk about it. But all I can tell you is from experience, from watching it for years and years and years, the timing, the threats of strikes or actual strikes, it's usually right around this time. Hmm. Anyway, and we're talking about a two-year budget. We're talking like $55 billion with a B, and Connecticut is a relatively small place. So we're talking large amounts of money. And everybody, by that I mean every single town, every single state agency, they all rely on the budget, and it's being crafted right now behind the scenes. The second thing, and we can jump onto another one, in the corner office up right underneath the press room, actually, in a corner office, they're negotiating SB 4, and SB 4 is Senate Bill 4, which means the electricity bill. They're trying electricity, as everybody listening knows, it's a big, big, big problem. They've never solved it. They've never solved it. You know, some people could say, oh, we solved it a little bit. I'm not saying they're going to snap their fingers and solve everything this year, but they should make some progress on it.
We have the radio is tough. We got to pay the piper more than we'd like to. We're going to take a break in a second. Then I want to get into maybe electricity and Pure a little bit, but I want to talk specifically about the budget because they had to go over the spending cap or maybe not. They didn't violate the spending cap, but I guess on paper they did. And I want you to explain that. And this isn't even the last of it because we might be dealing with some more shortfall.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Also Medicaid once the federal government figures stuff out, correct?
Yes, that is correct. What they did the other day had to do for the current fiscal year, and by that I mean the fiscal year that ends June 30th of this year. The budget that I was talking about a second ago, they're negotiating the next two-year budget, all right? So it's, as we call it, fiscal 26 and fiscal 27. What they did the other day, they were still worrying about fiscal 25, and the year's almost over. It's 11 out of 12 months, you're still fiddling with the budget from the current fiscal year. Normally, you don't do that. You don't have to do that normally.
Chris Keating, Hartford Current. You go to current.com, and it's K-E-A-T-I-N-G. He's been there for a couple of decades, and he covers state politics like nobody can. In terms of the budget, I believe that the 2017 deal was really important. Do you think that this incremental sort of going over the spending cap without changing the rules is the beginning of eroding what happened in 2017?
Maybe some people would want that, but I think Lamont will try to do some kind of a firewall to stop that. By that, I mean Lamont, for example, he's blocked tax increases. He's blocked capital gains increases. There's certain things. He's not really a line in the sand guy, and he won't shout the word veto, and he's not like Dan Malloy. Lamont's kind of a low-key guy, but on something of that nature, I think he will draw the line. He really wanted to hold the line on the spending cap. The way he views it is a 0.1%, 0.1% that they went over the cap.
Like 26 million or something.
Correct,
like
exactly. Which and again, you got to look at it in the context. The budget is 26 billion this year.
But they're going to have to come back in the fall, Chris. I'm told we don't know what the federal government say. It's 250 million in Medicaid cuts to Connecticut. They're going to have to get back together and find a way to pay for that.
Yes, post-Labor Day. You can expect them back post-Labor Day, not before then, because the reason being that the federal budget year starts October 1. Okay, we've been keep talking about the fiscal year and June 30th and all that. The federal year is October 1. That's the important date. Yes, they'll be back. They expect Trump administration Medicaid cuts. Correct, yes.
But then what do you do then in violation of the cap? Your point is they're not going to change the actual – they're not going to try to pass a bill changing the so-called guardrails. They're just going to find ways around it to get the money.
Yeah, well, but they will change the guardrails a little bit. I don't want to say it's like being a little bit pregnant, but in other words, they are going to change the guardrails to have an extra $300 million this year, and they're going to put that into child care, early childhood education, which everybody says is very, very important, and it is, obviously. So I don't want to say tweaks, but it's Lamont will not allow, I don't believe, like a full-blown knocking down of the guardrails.
Okay. And then there's Matt Ritter, the Speaker of the House, who wants to add $1 billion to the rainy day fund. He wants to siphon off the money, the surplus, which we still have, and which is kind of people come up to me, they're like, how can we have a surplus and have all these budget problems? Right.
Good.
And it's mainly because they can't access that money because it has to go in these places. But if he wanted to add $1 billion to the rainy day fund by siphoning it off and not having it go toward paying down pensions, can he just do that?
If Lamont goes along with that, they can do that. I was surprised.
They don't have to change the rule? They don't have to change the law? Or?
Usually you need a 3/5 vote to fiddle with the guardrails.
Okay.
I did ask Lamont about that the other day, and I was surprised. He actually said, yeah, you can put that over there, the extra billion in the rainy day fund that you just mentioned. And he said, but set it up for like 6 months. And if the Trump cuts don't come through,
then put it
then
back.
You take it back and send it to the pensions. And I said, how do you write the verbiage for that? And he said, how does that work? And you move things around? He said, yeah, something like that. It could be a temporary parking spot, like you putting extra money in your checking account, and then you find out the wedding is half price, and you can move the money back.
But on the flip side, the rainy day fund is for a rainy day. And if you had a shortfall of a couple hundred million in federal, Medicaid money, wouldn't that qualify as a rainy day? So is now $4 billion the floor that you never want to that you never want to go under?
No, that is a very good point. If you remember, if you dial back between Jody Rell and Dan Malloy, the rainy day fund was zero.
I know.
Zero, right. They spent every penny of it, okay? Now, at the far extreme, if you think to yourself, how could you spend every penny of it? Well, if you got a $4 billion hit from the feds, which nobody's talking about money of that nature, bango, you end up spending the whole amount of money.
Hey. It's like $4 billion now untouchable for like Armageddon, and then they're going to do something like this every time there's a problem, as long as there's a surplus?
I think Lamont would want it that way.
Okay.
Kind of have $4 billion as the floor. But again, like I said, how did the state survive in 2011 when it was zero? It's kind of like you working paycheck to paycheck and having no money in the bank at all, or pretty much.
I remember that. I'm pretty close to it now, but
I'm giving you an example.
I remember that. I ask this question a lot, and I don't know. I have this. I don't know the players as well as you, but I felt like this session's been a lot of Speaker Ritter, who I have very good conversations with. I don't know him that well personally, and I'd say the same about Lamont. It seems like he's sort of sending a message to Lamont that Lamont can't do anything without him. I don't know if that's true, and I don't know if there's tension between them, but I just I go back to that. You know, Lamont's going on a plane somewhere and he passes the special ed money while Lamont's on a plane. Like, I thought that that's not a signal of people who are in sync with each other.
It is basically true. Ritter understands that he is a powerful guy. He doesn't, walk around and put it in people's faces every day. But also, Ritter understands, and he said it the other day at the presser, Lamont is a powerful dude. Lamont might not put it in your face. What do I mean by that? Ritter understands he's got the votes to raise the capital gains taxes on rich people. He's got the 76 votes.
Yeah.
But he probably doesn't have veto override votes, which is 101. That's a lot of votes, and there's only 102 House Dems, and there's some moderates in there. So before you know it, you lose two people. You don't have the override. What does all that mean? You can't do it. Lamont can block a series of things. Lamont is very powerful. Ritter is powerful, yes. Any House Speaker is powerful, yes. But it's a bit of a dance. Mm. Who's more powerful? Nobody can just snap their fingers and make it happen.
Yeah.
Because if they could, they would have solved electricity and all these other issues we're talking about would have been solved.
Yeah. We didn't even get time to get into Pura, which is a fascinating thing for me because it sounds pretty convincing that she was involved in that editorial. I mean, it's hard to it's hard to not think that based on the evidence. But we don't have time for that today. We'll get in. By the way, thank you for coming in. I love spending time with you.
Yes,
we got a minute left. Lamont said he'll make his decision public on whether to run after the end of this session. We're like 3 weeks. What two and a half, 3 weeks away. Where are you right now on that?
I think he's going to push it off. The other day he said something about the summer, which is a little more vague.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to announce it the day after June.
You think he'll wait till after the special session then? That's pretty late.
Well, not super late. It depends. In other words, if he's running again, he can wait longer. All right. If he's not running, he's got to let these other guys raise money because they can't raise the money the way Lamont can just write a check for himself.
Right.
I think it's 50-50 on Lamont.
That's such an equivocation. Come on.
Hold on. It's a totally personal decision. By that, I mean, it has nothing to do with Aaron Stewart or who's running or anything at that at all.
Yeah.
It's 100% personal to Lamont. By that, I mean, he's 71 now. If he became governor, he'd be 73. When he left, he'd be 77.
Yeah.
Does he want to be doing this when he's 77 or not? That's the only consideration in my mind. The money, he's got enough. It doesn't matter. Obviously, he talks to Annie. It's between Annie and Ned, and that's it.
Chris Keating, you go to current.com. You can read his stuff. And you're heading over to the Capitol from here?
Yes, I am.
I love the press room. Old school filing cabinets.
You got it.
Stuff on the wall from the Roland administration. It's phenomenal.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.